You're listening to United Nations Association in Canada's Between Two Flags podcast series. UNA Canada's mandate is to educate and engage Canadians on the work of the UN and international issues of importance to us all. Through regular sessions, UNA Canada invites subject matter experts to discuss a wide range of issues related to the Sustainable Development Goals and the UN's work. Live tweet as you listen with hashtag Between Two Flags.
Hello everyone and welcome to today's episode of Between Two Flags. Today on our show we have Daniel Bida, who will be talking to us about his efforts in biogas and regeneration. And obviously we can edit parts out that I'm not getting correct, so I'm not sure I get that part correct.
That's alright, I believe in regeneration.
There you go. And we've got Ian Chow, Project Officer for Canada Green Corps, and myself, Nathan Adams, Senior Project Officer at Green Spaces. So, Daniel, it's a pleasure to have you here today. Please tell us about yourself and everything that you do.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. So, I guess everything that I do is kind of a varied question, but as it pertains to biogas, what we do at ZooShare, well, maybe just to back up a little bit, what I do at ZooShare is I'm the executive director and one of the founders of the organization. And so, largely what I do every day is a myriad of different tasks, from checking in with the engineers and the permitting process, to working through the financing process, to reporting back to our board, to working with our communications person to ensure all of our membership are well informed of our project status. There's just various administrative tasks that you got to do day to day when you're running an organization, whatever kind of organization it is. And so some of that's part of my job too. And then what we're doing, I guess, in a larger sense at ZooShare is we're building a biogas plant at the zoo. And what we're going to do at that biogas plant is take in a combination of zoo manure and commercial organic waste from the business sector, or in the waste world, we call that the IC&I sector, institutional, industrial, and commercial. That's the various acronym there. And so that material goes into our biogas facility, which is not yet operating, but will be by this time next year. And so the material, it comes into our site regularly, basically because the waste never stops. And so we need to be operational and open. I don't want to say 24/7, like trucks arrive in the middle of the night, but the idea of managing these flows of material is that there's always a place for it to go, because there's always the grocery store selling it to us, and there's always our refrigerators where it goes bad sometimes, and then there's the green bins where we throw it away. And so since we all never stop doing that, the facilities that take in this material need to be up and running on a reliable basis as well. And so the material will come in, the commercial stuff will first need to be pasteurized, which is a regulatory rule to ensure food safety on the back end. In essence, the material that comes out of the biogas plant is fertilizer, and so to ensure that all of the bacteria and pathogens that may be in the commercial waste are killed, you need to pasteurize the material prior to anaerobic digestion. So that's the first thing that happens. That means it's sitting at about 70 degrees Celsius for 1 hour. That's what pasteurization is in this case. And then it will be pumped into the anaerobic digester. So we're talking about both the manure and the commercial food waste. So the anaerobic digester works essentially like a big concrete stomach. It's kept at the same temperature as our bodies, 38 degrees Celsius more or less. The material inside there is digested by a whole suite of microbes and bacteria that eat it. And through that process, over a period of about 30 days, we'll convert all of that material into a combination of gases and what we call digestate, which just means digested material. But through that digestion process, they extract the methane gas which is the primary thing that we're using to generate energy. Biogas is actually a combination of methane and carbon dioxide, as well as a few other trace gases. So the carbon dioxide is about 30 to 35% of the mix. It doesn't have any energy component to it, but the methane is very energy rich gas. And natural gas that we use all the time to heat our homes and cook with is 99.9% methane. And so the simplest way to think about the biogas is that it's a lower grade natural gas. Now, one of the aspects of the biogas sector that's very much developing is renewable natural gas. And so that means basically removing the carbon dioxide from the gas so that you get to that 99.9% methane content. That was a little tangential, but essentially at our biogas plant, what we're doing is not making renewable natural gas, we're making renewable power. And so after the material is digested for that 30-day period and it releases almost all of the methane that it's going to release, the gas then goes into our combined heat and power generator, where it is combusted to make heat and power. The 500 kilowatts worth of power that we can generate are exported onto the Ontario grid, so that when you turn the lights on, you're not necessarily using fossil fuel power or nuclear power or renewable power. You're using a combination of all of those electrons. And we're contributing to the mix. And the heat that's generated is then used to keep the process going. So you can imagine keeping a digester at 38 degrees Celsius in the middle of winter is a difficult thing without any added heat. And so the heat that's created from generating electricity cycles through our facility again to keep the pasteurizer at 70 degrees, to keep the digester at 38 degrees, and to keep the whole thing going. I mean, once it gets going, this biological mechanical system is self-sustaining in that it's creating heat from the gas that it creates, which is then used to digest more material and create more gas, and the cycle keeps going. In a larger sense, the cycle keeps going in the sense that we're taking what previously was food and is now considered to be food waste, and we're converting it into energy and fertilizer that will be used to grow more food. And so the real victory in generating biogas is a fewfold, and it's one that, okay, you get energy as a byproduct from processing the organics in this way relative to processing it in a compost facility where you don't generate energy, but you just generate compost. In the biogas process, you get energy in the middle, so to speak, and then you end up with a product that's not dissimilar to compost, which we plan on selling to farmers and the public as another revenue stream to support the project.
So, and just for us to be a bit more clear, could you quantify for us how much power is going to make, perhaps in how many homes per year, and how much compost you're going to make? Just some numbers for us?
Sure, absolutely. So, starting at the beginning of the process, we're taking in 2,000 tons of zoo manure and 15,000 tons of commercial organic waste. That material will come to the facility throughout the year to create the 500 kilowatts of electricity, which is approximately equivalent to 250 Ontario homes, just based on our average consumption here in Ontario. If we all were more energy efficient, you could get more homes out of that amount of power, but that's just based on the averages. And then what comes out at the end of the day, you get some volume loss because it's converted to gas, but we're still going to be left with a significant amount of the fertilizer material, about 12,000 tons a year of this material, which has a lot of water in it. And the reason for that is the food we eat has a lot of water in it, and when you're digesting it, it starts to separate in its various components. The water is full of nutrients, though, And so you're left with some solid material, you're left with this watery, nutrient-rich material, and all of it is excellent fertilizer to grow more food, whether it's a corn crop or in our garden in the backyard.
Thank you.
So you had also mentioned the biogas is about 35% CO2. Is there a process in which you filter out the CO2 before feeding into the grid, or is that part of your downstream responsibility?
So are you speaking from an emissions, you know, trying to reduce greenhouse gas perspective, or are you just trying to understand the gas cleaning process?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll reveal why I asked the question like that in a second. So basically, from a combusting the gas to make electricity perspective, no, we do not clean the CO2. You have to clean out the sour gases that are part of biogas because they'll tend to corrode the engine equipment. But when you burn carbon dioxide as a gas, you get nothing. Like, it stays carbon dioxide. But when you burn methane, you get energy and carbon dioxide as your byproducts. And why that's meaningful is because, you know, we're thinking here about reducing greenhouse gas emissions as our, let's say, end goal, and cleaning up the power grid as part of that goal. But what biogas does is that it also touches on our waste system. And so when our waste goes to a landfill, specifically organic waste, and it gets buried underneath other waste, it's creating a little bit of the same process that happens in the biogas plant. Except in the landfill example, oftentimes the gas that's created is released to the atmosphere. So that same 65% methane, 35% CO2 is going up into the air. And so why that's meaningful is because methane is between 25 and 80 times as powerful as carbon dioxide when it comes to trapping greenhouse gases in our, or heat in our atmosphere. And so when you burn methane to convert it to energy and CO2, you're actually converting it from something that's 25 times as powerful to just the one time. And so that's the real emission reduction benefit of generating biogas, is that you're capturing that methane and combusting it, which in and of itself is called methane destruction. Like, it's often something that happens at natural gas, like fracking facilities or pipelines. Sometimes they'll have to flare. And so that flare is really just so that you could burn the methane rather than releasing it straight to the atmosphere. The actual, so from, you know, talking in circles there a little bit, but the actual math of how it goes is, if we are taking 15,000 tons of a commercial organic waste a year, and those 15,000 tons were to go instead to a landfill that did not collect landfill gas, as some of them do, it would result in, for each ton of waste, it would result in approximately 1.39 tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. And so by capturing all of that material, that's all of those emissions, those like 20,000 tons of emissions per year are eliminated. But because we're still burning something, anytime you burn anything, you're releasing some gas into the atmosphere. But we're releasing about 10 tons per year through the combustion of the biogas. So on a net basis, it's a significant reduction, and it all has to do with that methane destruction.
So our next question is from our Canada Green Corps participant, Rachel. So Daniel, how do you think that rural and remote communities can maximize local waste to form renewable energy and products based on your model?
So I think the big thing in rural and remote communities is sizing the biogas plant appropriately. You know, as I've said numerous times, everywhere there's humans that are eating and relying on you know, whether it's a farm or a supermarket system to feed them, there's going to be organic waste. Whether that comes from our bodies or the animals that we rely on to eat sometimes, or, you know, just the fruit and vegetables and all the other food that we eat, all of that material could be collected and digested. And so for a rural and remote community, it's just about looking at all of the resources that are created in that community. And I'm referring to waste as a resource here, not, you know, oil and minerals being the resource or the trees, but actually the waste material. And just saying, okay, collectively, we 200 people make this much material through our wastewater, through our consumption, through our animals, through our farming, you know, whatever it may be. Let's try to collect as much of it as we can and then put it into the digester that's sized based on what we estimated we could produce in the first place. And then the real benefit of doing that for a lot of the rural and remote communities is that, I mean, they a lot of times need to be using diesel fuel for almost all of their electricity needs in those communities. That's a very dirty fuel, not only from a greenhouse gas perspective, but also just from a particulate matter in the air. You know, people who live around those facilities tend to breathe dirtier air. And so we could generate cleaner biogas for their needs. And we could also solve a lot of their waste issues, because often also what happens is they'll have a little landfill site somewhere in the community that's just a little bit off from where everyone lives. And so we can keep a lot of the organics out of that landfill site, which would reduce birds and other pests and those kinds of things. And then furthermore, we'd be making fertilizer locally that they could use to grow food locally as well. And so it fits right into the system, I think. But the most important aspect of all of it is sizing the digester appropriately. These are capital intensive machines. And so if you overbuild, you'll overspend on your capital costs, and you'll feel the greater pressure to repay those costs, whether it's to the bank or your investors. And that will make you then start wanting to bring material from other communities around you, which isn't a bad idea. There is benefits of scale in this industry. It's just a matter of how remote is this community that we're talking about. If there's three or four other rural remote communities that are just a few kilometers away, maybe it does make really good sense to aggregate material from all of those communities into one digester so that you can maximize the benefit and benefits of economies of scale.
I'll just ask you one last question. We can always. So, Daniel, what inspired you to pursue this career path? And what advice do you have for our youth participants who are interested in also following similar career in the long term?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I can answer in 2 minutes, so I'll give it a go here. I like to talk, I guess. So what inspired me to get into this career path was partly dissatisfaction with my current job. So I went to university and studied finance. I was very eager to be a person on Bay Street that picked stocks and just made too much money. But like, I just wasn't happy with the work that I started to do when I graduated. You know, what seemed glamorous to me from my outside view actually meant sitting at my desk often by myself and reading reports all day and writing reports all day and not really interacting with a lot of other humans and reading a lot of dry material and writing reports that I didn't feel very inspired by, and I'm not really sure anybody really read. And so, you know, just being somebody that wanted to make an impact on the world, you know, not really knowing what that impact was, but just wanting to do something, I really wasn't feeling it. But what I was doing as a job at that time was covering the global electric utility sector. And so that got me learning about how electricity is made. And as somebody who has always cared about the environment, I tended to look more favorably upon the renewable technologies that the utilities were building, which at the time was mostly large-scale wind farms and hydroelectric projects, but still being, you know, carbon-free sources of electricity that didn't have fuel risk, i.e. the prices of the fuels didn't change, it was just the wind blows or the water flows or the sun shines. Those things appealed to me. They just seemed smart, and they seemed very much like the future, given what we knew about climate change and global warming and all those buzzwords, but ultimately that we knew something was happening here and something different needed to be happening when it came to our generation of electricity. All of that being said, I didn't know anything about biogas from that work. It's too small for a utility to pay any attention to. Utilities like to generate hundreds of megawatts at a time. Half of a megawatt is not appealing to them in terms of, you know, effort and money and their needs. So it didn't cross my path at all. And so what happened from there was I was just looking for more meaningful work. And I came across a biogas company here in 2008. And I went for a job interview there, and you know, you do all your research before you go to a job interview. Like, you know, what does this company do? Am I interested in it? Like, what may I do there, kind of thing. And it just left me really intrigued. I going into the interview, it seemed like something exciting that you could take. So that you could take waste and make power, and then the waste of that process was fertilizer. There was no waste in and of itself. So, you know, talk about adding value to an existing process. I couldn't believe it, how powerful it was, and I couldn't believe that there wasn't more of these systems around. And so I walked away from the job interview, not with a job, but with a whole lot of intrigue. And so when a few years later, I mustered up the confidence to start my own company, and there was a whole wave of renewable energy development going on here in Ontario, it seemed natural for me to just keep going down that path. What was funny about it to me at the same time was that once I got into the path, I started thinking about how much in my life historically I'd been paying attention to waste. You know, I was that kid that was telling his mom, like, why are you putting the newspaper in the garbage can? Like, that's crazy. It's recyclable. What's the matter with you? You know, and that was, I think, like fourth grade or something. And so just, it's an anecdote that stuck with me, but that was the kind of thing that I was doing. I was already seeing waste and thinking about waste. So it really did seem like a natural evolution for me that I would start working in this industry.
Okay. I personally am finding this very interesting. I want to ask some more questions. Daniel, how do you think we can implement biogas-generated electricity in a more mainstream resource for Canada?
So in Ontario, we have this renewable power purchase program called the feed-in tariff program. And it's that program that was offering these 20-year contracts from the Ontario government at a premium price over the hourly electricity price. And that incentive is the reason why we have a renewable energy industry that got off the ground, because you had all of these developers chasing these contracts, and biogas was one of those technologies that they were willing to buy electricity generated from. Now, the reason I said what I said at the beginning of my answer was because it's actually not the most efficient thing to do with the biogas to burn it and make electricity from it. And the reason for that is when you burn biogas to convert it to electricity, you actually only have an electrical conversion efficiency ratio of about 35%, which means the other 65% of the energy in the gas is heat, and it's mostly not used, and so it's lost. Whereas if you were to pipe the gas to our homes to use in our furnace to heat, you would use almost 100% of the heat energy, or of the energy in the gas. If you were to put it in a natural gas vehicle, you would use almost 100% of the energy in the gas to power that vehicle. And so for that reason, I really don't see the future of biogas to be an electrical one, but one where we're feeding gas into pipelines or tanks to make refilling stations, those kinds of things, or even on-site needs like making gas out of the back of a food processing facility and then piping the gas back into the facility for their own heat needs is much more likely in Canada's future. And the way that all of that is going to happen isn't because of an incentive program that says, I'll pay you this much if you generate green heat. It'll be because we all, through policy and through some will, decide that we want to actually collect our organic waste and do something with it rather than bury it in a big hole and move on to consume new material. And the reason that I'm going down that path and why it's complex for one, but why it's necessary is to, and like, you know, we talked about those methane emissions that come from landfills. Very impactful from a greenhouse gas perspective. And if we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions because we believe we can make a difference still, you don't want to be sending it to a landfill and just doing what we've always done. You want to try to separate the garbage and the recyclables from the organic material so that you can make some biogas with it or even make compost with it. Because you get the energy, but really what I also see as even more beneficial of this whole process is that you get the nutrients. You're not losing them forever to the landfill and then needing to buy commercially produced nitrogen, which requires mining of potash and a whole bunch of natural gas to produce. You've got it right there from the food that you previously ate that you didn't quite eat all of. It can make more nutrients, which you could then use the next growing season. And so why I see this as really important is that that's a valuable cycle. And so when we, interrupt the cycle by putting it in a landfill, we're hurting ourselves, is my view of things. And so it does take more energy, like in terms of our collective energy, to separate waste, whether it's at home or it's at work or whether it's setting up business processes. It does cost more to separate, when you go to the grocery store and they sell strawberries in those plastic clamshells, the plastic clamshell doesn't make biogas and it doesn't become nutrients. It's plastic. It's potentially recyclable. But in order to separate those two streams, you either need to have your employees in the back of the store opening up individual strawberry packages and separating them, or you need to buy equipment that can do that for you, which adds cost in either way. And so most of the time what we've seen in our lives is that when you don't have to do something and it costs more, people choose the alternative. And so that's why I'm saying it's a policy and collective will type of challenge in order to make this happen. But there's no way that we're going to really make a lot of biogas unless we're actually diverting the material to biogas plants rather than throwing it in a landfill.
And based on your project in the Toronto Zoo, where do you see yourself and your company the next 5 years, the next 10 years? And what advice do you have for youth who want to get into the sustainable energy industry?
Okay, two very different questions there. So where do we see ZooShare in 5 to 10 years? Our plan is to expand the facility from the current one that we're building that, as I said, can generate 500 kilowatts worth of capacity. We're going to add a second digestion tank, double the amount of organic waste that comes into the facility, and then sell both renewable natural gas and renewable power from the facility. So we'll be one of the first ones that are selling both fuels or both sources of energy, whether we choose one day to sell electricity or to sell all gas. That'll essentially be an algorithm-based decision based on whichever one will pay us more money. But in either case, we'll be exporting a renewable energy source that is made from diverting organic waste away from landfills. And then the other thing that I see ZShare doing more of in the next 5 to 10 years are two things that it's just starting to do right now. And the first is educating kids and the public about the benefits of biogas and why it's important to separate and divert your organic waste. We have in-classroom programs that are running right now that teach kids about anaerobic digestion and what the actual value of the leftovers in from the lunchroom are, or the banana peels, what they're worth. So kids can start understanding that now, the same way that I learned about recycling in fourth grade. And when I grew up and became an adult, it was second nature. It wasn't something I ever thought about. And that's what we want to see happen for kids too. And I'm really heartened when I go to schools right now and I see how many programs already exist to help kids understand the value of compost and organic waste. So that's the first thing, is that we'll be a much more active, and there'll be more outreach across the country around the educational programming. And that's going to be complemented with tours of our facility. Once it's up and running next year, we're going to welcome the public at any time to walk across the street from the main zoo site, to take their school trip, to stop by on the weekend, to take a walk around and see what it's about. And really, to us, that's a very valuable thing. Being just outside the city of Toronto, like we are on the border, there's a lot of money in the city, there's a lot of professional smarts and energy in the city, and not a lot of those people know about biogas. Just quite simply, they don't know that it exists as an option, as a solution, as an idea. And we want those people to have the same kind of epiphanies that we had when we got into the space, which is that you can make biogas almost out of almost any organic waste stream. And once you start thinking about it, you start realizing how much waste you see everywhere and how much potential there is if we divert all of that material. So that's from a, you know, mission perspective, that's very big for ZooShare, and that's something we're going to be doing a lot more of. The other thing that we're going to be doing a lot more of in the next 5 to 10 years is selling fertilizer. So the initial iteration of our project, we'll see the fertilizer put in a truck, sent to a farm 5 kilometers away, and sprayed on the field to grow corn crop. That farmer is not going to pay us anything for it because he is a farmer, and by nature he's skeptical of new products that are being sold to him when he's been sold snake oil many times before. And so, you know, he just needs to see it proven. So we will prove it. That takes a couple years of growing trials. And then once it's a proven, you know, from a nutrient value, from a growing potential perspective, we will start selling it, some to farmers and some to gardeners under the ZooPoo brand name. And all of that is going to be geared towards us generating more revenue so that we can repay our bondholders and reinvest in our mission, which is just growing community biogas through education and investment in additional facilities.
And you intend to conduct research on crop yield and this kind of stuff based on the product giving the farmers?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to imply this is going to be very intensive research as much as just like plant a row of corn using digestate and plant a row of corn using like the traditional commercial fertilizers and then just look at the difference in your yield.
In terms of replicability and financing by the project like this, how feasible would it be to move this to a global south country, for example, for them to have a very similar system?
Very feasible. I mean, biogas as a concept really took off in the Indian subcontinent first. They have millions of very small biogas plants where they just put cow dung is often the primary fuel that they're feeding there. And the reason I brought up India is because of how warm it is there. And very much like the global south, you have the benefit of warmer ambient temperatures to keep your digester warm, which means that it's lower cost to build your biogas plant because you don't need as much of your own heat flowing through the system to keep it warm. It could become a little bit more self-sustaining and low tech as a result. But I mean, like I was saying about the rural and remote community, there's nothing stopping anybody from building a biogas plant anywhere. You just need to make sure you have enough fuel, the waste, and you have something to do with the fuel that you make, whether it's heating homes, cooking, some kind of industrial process, natural gas vehicles, electricity, whatever it is, you need to know what you're doing with it, and it needs to be worthwhile to do so. But a lot of the times a biogas project is worthwhile purely from a waste perspective. If you have so much waste to manage and you're running out of landfill space, or the landfill's on the other side of the country, or whatever it might be, or maybe it's contaminating your water supply because you guys are just dumping it next to the river kind of idea. All of those situations using an anaerobic digester could really clean up their local environment and benefit themselves while also making gas and fertilizer. And so it's very applicable to many locations around the world. It's highly replicable. The biggest challenge in the end is going to be cost. As I said earlier, these are mostly customized, custom-engineered, custom-built facilities. Anytime you have the word custom anything, your cost goes up. If you want to install biogas plants on a large-scale basis in many communities where, you know, money is a challenge, you need to get the cost down of the system. And so that's why what you're seeing more and more of, but it's still early days, are containerized modular biogas systems, which are not as big as the one that we're building at the Toronto Zoo, but can be produced in a factory and shipped and installed all within a month. and then you just start feeding it the waste you have. So, you know, in those rural and remote communities, I'm certainly picturing, you know, a containerized digester system shipped up there from a factory and, you know, plopped down on the ground, and they start feeding it and they start taking gas out at the other end. And that's how you manage the costs and get it to go.
Any advice you have to youth that might be interested in getting into this industry?
Oh, I see. Okay, right. This industry, being biogas or renewable energy in general, I think it doesn't really matter. It depends what you're interested in. And my best advice would be to figure out what you're interested in and then go expose yourself. Like, go to the conference. Try to volunteer there. You know, write to the companies that are operating in the industry and do informational industry interviews. Just ask them a bunch of questions to see if you actually like it. I mean, I think a lot of us, I certainly very much this, you know, when I was, you know, coming up through school and graduating, like, I wanted a job and I wanted to make some money. Those were my priorities, not what I was interested in. And, you know, I thought I was interested in something and, you know, it paid well, so I think that's why I was interested in it, but I wasn't truly interested in it. And so, you know, it wasn't until I just matured a bit more and started asking questions and spending time thinking about what interested me that I eventually found it. And so, you know, I really just encourage people to get out there and try different things and ask questions and figure out what they don't like. And, you know, I think I'm a big proponent in trial and error learning. You know, you can learn from other people's mistakes, absolutely, but you don't always know how you feel about something until you put yourself in the situation. And I find that there's the most possible learning opportunities in failing something. And so, you know, try something, fail it. That's a great learning opportunity. Don't just stay in your textbook and, you know, apply to jobs through the internet and email your resume all over. Because then you're not really putting yourself out there at all. You're kind of just taking lesser steps to get to maybe a lesser end goal. And personally speaking, I just don't find anybody's going to be satisfied without like fully getting where they want to be. And it takes a while to figure out what that is. So yeah, that would be my advice.
That's incredibly helpful advice and a good lesson for our listeners. So thank you very much for your time, Daniel. And thank you for tuning into our Between Two Flags podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great opportunity. Appreciate it.